Today my son came in and was like, oh, never mind. Show's on. Oh, no, keep going. You're in charge.
Oh, no, Garrett hit it, man. You can't do the whole, that's like, can't do that.
No. No, you got to save us from ourselves,
man. You got to commit, dude. You got to commit. Hey, everybody, I'm Connor Rosdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. None of us, as we like to say, is as smart as all of us. And that's especially true on days like today when Molly and I are just kind of rambling.
It is, because, yeah, I just literally started to tell a story. Like, we're just here to chit-chat. I don't know. I'm Molly Wood. It is What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. I mean, you know, this is our chance to hang out. We got to throw some stories in. Yeah. Today, of course, is our entire episode dedicated to answering your questions. One of my favorites of the week.
Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos, if you've heard the news, can I just say, by the way, I've already got my Make Me Smile for tomorrow. I'm so excited about it. And honestly,
really?
Make Me Smiles are sometimes the toughest things to find. Yeah, I've already got it. And as soon as that rundown goes up, I'm getting it in there because I don't want you to steal it.
Okay.
I've got mine already.
Okay.
I'm really excited.
Oh my God, I'm so excited, you guys. This is must-see podcast right here. Tune in tomorrow.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So we're going to go to your questions. This one comes from Tamsin in Nevada, and he wants to know, with Bezos stepping down as CEO at Amazon, and I'm going to have an ancillary question after this one. Can you please make me smart about Amazon's move to brick and mortar stores? At a time when the pandemic is surging and e-commerce is booming, why do I see notifications about Amazon Fresh and other stores opening up? That's Tamsin in Nevada. Over to you, Ms. Wood, because I don't have the answer.
We don't. Okay. Well, we have a lot of data, and then I have what I think actually might be a bit of an answer, because obviously sales have gone down during the pandemic. Shoppers have cut those brick and mortar store trips, but Amazon, as Tamsin points out, is still opening lots more of these Amazon Fresh stores, where you can go and, you know, skip the checkout line and you just sort of, it's all like the cool digital stores. There's suspicion that it might be competition from Target and Walmart with respect to those stores, because those companies use their store fleets as fulfillment centers. And that was also a big reason people thought behind Amazon purchasing Whole Foods, is that not only can it sell groceries, but it can use each individual Whole Foods location as a fulfillment center. Like, you can come and pick up or drop off your Amazon stuff here. They have that partnership now with Kohl's, where you can take returns to Kohl's to drop them off there.
Oh.
So on the one hand, I think there's an argument that Amazon is trying to build a bigger, broader physical infrastructure to serve its e-commerce sales.
Yeah.
I also think, and I think this partly because of the push to slower delivery. Like, a lot of times when you order stuff now, you'll find that there are options like save 2% or 5% if you do the, like, you don't care when it gets there delivery. There's also a big push with the Whole Foods ordering toward pickup. And a thing that I have been saying since roughly 1999, around the pets.com era, not just me. This is how old I am, but I'm just saying that sometimes your age gives you wisdom. And that thing is, delivery is a bad business. It's expensive.
Oh, yeah.
There are very few companies that have been able to crack delivery, you know, successfully. Witness the unbelievable efforts you saw in California by Uber and Lyft and DoorDash to make sure they didn't have to pay their drivers as employees, to try to keep them as independent contractors. But even as independent contractors, they're expensive. And I think that even for a behemoth like Amazon, there may be more value in trying to just get people to go to the store, because then you don't have to pay so much to get stuff to them. This is a theory.
Look, in their last earnings report, maybe two times ago, Amazon said it spent, like, honestly, tens of billions of dollars getting our stuff to us. And it's just, it's gobsmacking how expensive it is. Although, do you remember, and this was not all that long ago, right, when the competition was not next day delivery, not even same day delivery, but same nanosecond delivery. Like, you click and boom, it's there, right? It was like all about speed, and we're going to put all these, you know, fulfillment centers within, you know, drone range of your house. And I guess they're kind of moving away from that, because as you said, it's totally expensive. Okay. So that's the listener question. Here's mine.
Okay.
What make you, Ms. Wood, of the change in the C-suite at Amazon?
Yeah, I think it's super interesting. And it's clear that Jeff Bezos had stepped away from day-to-day decision-making. Like, there was a big article midway through the pandemic, I think in the summer, about how he had kind of come back in to the day-to-day decision-making because the pandemic was such a big logistical challenge. And it was like, oh, crap, we need, you know, Jeff is like, I need to re-engage. But it seems like he had been taking on the role of chairman anyway. That said, it's a huge, look, it is a huge deal when a founder CEO steps away. Like, you just see a difference in the company. And I think I said on the Marketplace Morning Report, I think this is a big indicator, the fact that it's Jassy who currently runs AWS, the cloud services division.
Right.
Like, if delivery loses you money, or not, you know, Amazon's not losing money, but if a delivery costs you a bunch of money, cloud services prints it. Money printer go brr. With the cloud services.
I almost spit out my coffee. Yeah. I think I got coffee on my nose, actually. Yeah. That's
so
right.
I wouldn't be surprised if we see a shift, you know, toward a little less interest in doing everything, Amazon being the everything store and getting into every single business, because they've literally found the golden egg. And I would imagine that over time we're just going to see all the resources, all the food going to that goose. So many metaphors happened there.
Sense.
So many.
there was a lot in there. All right.
Yeah. All right. Back to you and your questions. Our next one is about the state of the economy, on a topic on which we all have questions. Yeah, Eric in Utah sent us this.
Are we still in a recession? I'm starting to hear a lot of folks in the media reference the recession in the past tense, but based off of all the stuff you guys talk about on the show with unemployment numbers and GDP, it seems like we are very much still in a recession.
Excellent question.
Over to you.
Let's do two things right away. Yeah. Let's do two things right away. One is, a lot of people out there probably still believe, because they have been told for years and years and years, that a recession is defined by two quarters of negative economic growth, which is the economist's way of saying two quarters in a row in which the economy shrinks. That is not the guidance anymore. What happens now is that a group of people who sit on what is known as the Business Cycle Dating Committee of the National Bureau of Economic Research look at all kinds of data. And they look at, like, unemployment and aggregate demand and all sorts of stuff and say, okay, and they do it in retrospect, right? They do it like 6 months later. They say the economy went into a recession there, except they don't say the recession. What they say is the peak of the economic cycle was there, whenever they decide. And they're going to eventually look back on the beginning of the recession and they're going to say, okay, February 2020 was the peak of the previous cycle. That is to say, we were at maximum economic growth for that cycle. We were at minimum unemployment. Things were looking good. And then things fell off the table. And that'll be February, March of 2020. The thing is about this particular recession, that it was like a snap recession. It happened almost instantaneously. And then almost as quickly, relatively speaking, the indicators changed. Unemployment started falling, business activity started picking up, GDP, that is to say economic growth, started picking up. And so probably by like April, May, the recession was technically over. But as you can see, we're still not going to restaurants. We're still not flying. We're still not doing X, Y, and Z. So there's subdued economic activity, right? But a technical recession is probably over. Now, one more thing to say. And this is the History is Cool part of this podcast. In the Great Depression, there was actually a recession within the Depression. So in 1937, give me 45 seconds to geek out on history here. In 1937.
Take all the seconds. This is awesome.
Okay. In 1937, after having gotten through the worst of the Depression, right, Franklin Roosevelt, under pressure from Republicans, frankly, started pulling back on some of his assistance. Okay, on some of the government programs that had been propping up the economy. And in 1937, there was a recession within the Depression. So there had been economic growth, and then it all just went, right? And things were lousy until basically World War II. So you can have recessions within greater economic periods of being subdued. I'm not going to call this a depression, right? That would be, you could call it a double dip recession. You can call it a bunch of things. But the recession, I'm sure, started in February, March. It was probably over by April or May. And now the challenge is to keep it going so that we don't have another recession within this greater period of subdued economic growth. And that, of course, gets us to the politics of this and the Biden plan and all the rest of that stuff. But that's the deal.
That's so fascinating on many levels, yeah. Not least of which is that there seems like there could be a pretty good economic paper written, and clearly there have been many written, on how you don't penny pinch recoveries.
Oh, my God. Shouldn't. Well, look, I mean, come on.
I mean, that's the whole conversation now, right? You have all these people saying exactly this, right? We learned our lesson.
Right. You bet.
Some people are saying that.
Clearly we didn't. Half of the American body politic, or a better way to put that is half of the United States Congress, doesn't believe that we learned our lesson. And that's the challenge that Biden and the Democrats are having right now with the Republicans, right? We know what happened. We went too small, too slow in 2009, and the recession lasted, let me rephrase that, and the economy took 10 years to recover. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're looking at now.
And what I had not realized, I mean, this is philosophically a political difference, right? The mm-hmm. standard Republican line being smaller government is better and debt is bad. But you've just given the example of the Depression. In 2008, mm-hmm. 2009, in that recession, Republicans negotiated for a significantly smaller package. And then most of them did not vote even for that. I didn't realize that just the other night that I think only three Republicans voted for that bailout package at all. And one of them became a Democrat shortly after. And now Republicans you see pushing for a smaller package now. And I'm just saying maybe as a matter of economic policy, they might be not right.
Yeah.
Maybe they're waiting to be right. And they think it's going to be this time. But yeah, that's
It's interesting and infuriating to watch happen because we've literally seen this movie before. You know?
Yep.
Okay. So back to your question.
Dramatic shift in tone to the next question.
Coming up right here. Remember back, maybe you don't remember, but I did an interview about this actually. Back when the pandemic started, people were talking about a baby boom because people in their apartments or houses, not much to do. Anyway, here you go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Shannon and Jason from Minneapolis. Here's our question. It has been over 9 months since the pandemic and the quarantine started. Are we seeing a change in the birth rate, either a baby bust like during the 1918 pandemic or a baby boom as many jokingly predicted at the start?
And assuming there is a change, is the change different for first-time parents versus those who already had kids going into these lockdowns?
We have a 5-year-old and a 1-year-old, and while we love them a ton, it's been stressful balancing working from home with all the daycare closures, etc. And it must be even harder on families trying to manage homeschooling. So I have to think that couples who already had kids going into this are thinking about a slower approach. Thanks.
May I just say I love everything about this?
Oh, no joke. I know some people who are thinking about not having a second child.
Yeah, I bet.
So, you know.
I bet.
Yeah.
I have two comments on this voice memo. One, way to raise the game, Shannon and Jason, with the tag team radio production voice memo.
Yeah.
And two, if I had to guess, I would say that Shannon and Jason are having a conversation right now about whether to have more kids.
Oh, for sure.
Possibly leading to this question. Look, I cannot imagine a scenario. I know my cousin in Alaska, and I'm super excited. They just had a baby yesterday. So I know of one. Yep, I know of one boom. But they didn't have any kids before. If you have been home with your children, and you have seen, especially for women, the way this country has treated you, the way your workplace has probably treated you, the complete lack of help that you have received from schools, which frankly can't help you because they themselves are overwhelmed, from state and local governments that don't have any money and haven't prioritized you in the first place, and the federal government, don't even get me freaking started. You can totally imagine why no thank you is the answer to should we have more children.
Get away from me.
Get away from me with this.
Thing,
America.
Right. I did an interview actually on the show like 2 months ago, maybe, with a woman from, I think, the University of Maryland about a Brookings study that had showed about 300,000 to 500,000 fewer babies will be born this year because of all the things Molly was talking about. Mm-hmm. And that, just to frame it in a marketplace sensibility, is a huge labor market issue in 18 years.
It sure is.
Just saying.
Yep. Yeah. And so, and there is, to be clear, our producers have given us research to say that, yes, and 9 months after it was declared a pandemic, initial data from at least 5 states show birth rates dropping significantly. Data from a survey found that 40% of women changed their plans about when to have kids because of COVID-19. So we were already in a little bit of a baby bust that is only going to be exacerbated. And I'm sorry, only parent-friendly policy is going to get women back on this train because... Mm-hmm. There's no patriotic duty here.
Totally.
I was thinking about when that time we did that show and I said it was BS when we were talking. I was like, God, I've really been mad about this women thing for the whole pandemic.
Oh, yeah.
Reasonably.
Okay. Yeah.
But I was like, man, I even said a swear on the show about it. Yeah, all right.
You know what? That's
I'm not gonna lie, I've been putting this one off. But here we go. Ron in Texas. Sent us an email about one of apparently Kai's whole audience, including Kai's favorite topic. He writes, when did hazy beer become a thing? A homebrewer friend of mine says it indicates a bad batch. Are brewers making lemonade from lemons? Go, Kai.
I don't know, but they taste really good. I really am enjoying hazy IPAs. I've got a new favorite, actually, from a brewery up near you that sadly doesn't deliver statewide, which is kind of bumming me out. And I may actually just ping you to go get some and sip it to me. But that's a whole different thing. So
I will.
Hazy IPAs. No, you won't. That's ridiculous. The hottest thing within that already popular category. So we got freelance beer reporter Kate Burnott on the line. She said the Hazy IPA was essentially created by a couple of brewers in Vermont in the early 2000s. Here you go.
And these three Vermont brewers, who were all very influenced by each other, were all collaborating very closely, at times worked all for each other, began to realize that in their pursuit of the ultimate aromatic and flavorful IPA, that often resulted in IPAs that had a little bit of haze to them. And this was shocking at the time. And a lot of brewing purists, you know, were scratching their heads over this. But they drinkers really appreciated them and loved how different and flavorful and aromatic these beers were from other IPAs of the time, which were kind of bitter and very clean and more about the piney, resinous flavors than fruity, soft flavors that these hazy IPAs were displaying. But anyway, we've come to accept and enjoy an IPA that is not exactly crystal clear.
Amen. Also, I'm in the wrong field. I need to become a beer reporter. I would just like to say that. Mm-hmm. But look, in all seriousness, so leave it to the professionals. If you're homebrewing, you're going to want to take a sniff or two before you drink your own hazy IPA. That's all I'm saying. Just be careful.
I will say, as someone who has not been a fan of IPAs, her description of a hazy IPA made it sound more appealing. So maybe when February is over, I'll try one.
They're softer. That's the thing.
Yeah.
I mean, for a long time, IPAs were chewy and robust and really like heavy. Hazies are a little softer. Anyway.
I could be down. I'll consider it.
Okay.
Consider it. All right. That is it for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday, which I think we can all agree is such a wide-ranging delight, thanks to all of you. Thank you for your good questions and your voice memos and your comments. It is the best. MakeMeSmart@Marketplace.org. Emails are good, but voice memos are better. And tag team voice memos are boss level.
The best. Sorry. Just wait for that.
Yep.
There we go. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner produces other stuff, digital and analog. Eric Phillips writes our newsletters, also our smart speaker skills.
Today's program was engineered masterfully by Garrett Lang, who pinged me midway through and was like, your headphones are too loud. True story. Thanks for looking out for me and our audio quality. Ben Tolliday and Danny Ramirez composed our theme music. Donna Tam is the senior producer and the executive director of On Demand. It's Zatara Nieves. I know, it was awesome. Totally worked too. Awesome. I turned it up because I was watching TikToks. It's my fault.
Oh, well, that's the important thing.
It's cute animals on TikTok. It happens a lot.
I still just think it's a huge time suck. I mean, I've got time for one time suck, and that's Twitter, and that's all I got.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.